You know, as Micah Hank says, we are confronted with a technology that history and science just cannot fully explain. Stand by, because in a moment you're going to hear an incredible story. It's called the Ghost Rockets. What are they? Micah Hanks joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Of course, writer, researcher, sometimes skeptic, Micah Hanks addresses a variety of the unexplained, including cultural phenomena, human history, prospects of our technological future. Hanks is also the executive editor for Intrepid Magazine, consulting editor for Fate Magazine, and the Journal of Anomalous Sciences. He also writes for a variety of other publications, including UFO Magazine, A Mysterious Universe, New Dawn. A number of books out there, by the way. Reynolds Mansion, which is an invitation to the past, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, The UFO Singularity, author of course now, The Ghost Rockets. Micah, always a pleasure. Welcome back.
Well, hey, George, always my pleasure to be here with you.
My gosh, Ghost Rockets, what are they?
That's the $65 million question, I suppose,
it
isn't
sure
it?
Is.
You know, for me, and I'll say this right up front, I think ghost rockets are many things. As far as UFO research goes, something we're going to no doubt get into a good bit later in the program and throughout the course of this conversation are the original ghost rockets reports, which emanate from around Scandinavia, particularly Sweden in 1946. And I use this term, ghost rocket, throughout this new book with the intention of using something that is familiar to UFO researchers, but as people who pick up this book and read this will find, it's not just these reports from 1946 in Sweden that may have been some terrestrial technology that was being tested in secret. Who knows? Historical documentation doesn't seem to account fully for that, at least in terms of Allied technology or maybe, you know, secret Russian tests or anybody else that was known to have been testing this kind of thing at that time. But being something that, in terms of UFO history, is a familiar term, I use this across the board to refer to a lot of different cases. And this book brings us right up to the present day with continued reports of UFOs that resemble rockets and missiles and the like. So this is a very interesting subject, and I found it's something that's not been discussed a lot in the UFO literature in relation to these more recent encounters, and that's what I like to call the ghost rockets.
And of course, you approach this with a skeptical mind, but you've come up with some fascinating conclusions here, haven't you?
Well, yeah, and you know, I like the way that you introduced me there. You know, sometimes skeptic. I think it's important to always be skeptical. And as my friend Dr. Robert Schock recently said on an ancient alien cruise that he and I attended together, you know, he said we should always be skeptical of everything. But the important thing to do is also not dismiss facts when they're sitting right there in front of us. And, you know, with this subject, the ghost rockets, sure, I'm very careful when I'm looking at an apparent technology that could be of earthly origin. When we're talking about missiles and projectiles, generally that's not something that's so far out there, so exotic, that we would need to employ, for instance, an alien idea behind this to explain it. But, you know, with the greater context of UFO phenomenon, that possibility certainly exists. What I'm trying to do, quite simply, is just find out where the facts lead. There is a necessity for skepticism, but I'm not the kind of skeptic that's a denier, a debunker, or a dismisser. I just want the facts.
Okay. Well, we're going to get these facts, and we're going to talk about all the many things that are out there. You have documented some conversations between pilots, it looks like, and FAA employees in the tower, if I read that correctly. What's going on there?
Well, you know, the thing is that, and this is what's really interesting. When we want to try and find good information about UFOs, one problem that has existed, I think, since day one is being able to find evidence of everything from radar data to also just, you know, reputable sources of eyewitness encounters. With this subject, you know, it's probably important for me to back up a little and talk about what really got me interested in this. I have a lot of friends who I've made over the years. Some of them I've never met in person. They'll reach out to me. They'll hear a podcast I do. They'll hear me on an interview like Coast to Coast or something like this. And they'll reach out to me and say, you know, my background is in, you know, aviation, or my background is in engineering. I've worked with the space program for a number of years. Or maybe I'm a cell microbiologist or a historian. Sadly, a lot of these folks, because of the way that I think academia tends to treat subjects like UFOs, they could never go out there and do what I do, put their actual physical name, and that Micah Hanks is my real name, it's not a pseudonym.
That's it.
I, they can't do like what I've done, and they can't put their name behind this because, unfortunately, it's just not generally accepted in the world today. And that is a little sad, but they're nonetheless comfortable to tell me, listen, keep my identity secret, but here's what I know. And I had a gentleman who I've corresponded with for years with a background in aerospace and engineering bring to my attention some reports that have been maintained in databases, specifically what's called the Aviation Safety Reporting System, which is maintained by NASA. This is one of the first places he began pointing out reports that were maintained and kept from anonymous sources, pilots, officials with the FAA, sometimes air traffic control. These reports, the Aviation Safety Reporting System, which date back to as early as 1988, did document in a few instances anomalous aerial phenomenon. In a number of cases, George, and this is what's really compelling to me, the objects were described as being bullet-shaped, torpedo-shaped, missile-shaped, or like projectiles, but often behaving in ways that you wouldn't expect a missile or a projectile to behave. They almost act more like drones, and they fly dangerously close in many instances to aircraft. So that, of course, was compelling, even a little frightening maybe. And so I began to dig into this, going all the way back to the 1940s cases and looking, you know, at the years and the decades in between. And it seems that consistently across the board, yes, there are reports of these missile-like, you know, UFOs by proper terminology, unidentified flying objects, they certainly are. And a majority of these reports, like you've asked, they do deal with aviation professionals and people who I think are maybe a cut above the average UFO witness in terms of their reliability and their ability to determine aspects technically about what they're observing.
Is there any chance, Micah, that these ghost rockets might be some kind of high technology, maybe the Nazi technology or the Black Ops military program that we hear so much about?
Yeah, you know, that is always something that has interested me. I'll share an interesting story about that because, you know, the Black Ops stuff, I think anyone who seriously is involved in UFO research has to at some point consider how much of this technology, or if could any of it, could it be our own? Could there really be technology that advanced right here in our midst? And I find that, you know, I've spoken with people who are very mixed about that. I've you know, had people tell me, yes, it's going on, yes, it's happening, the kinds of stuff that we popularly hear about going on allegedly at Area 51 and locations like that really does happen, and we've got some pretty far-out stuff. And then I've talked with people who don't buy that. One skeptical commentator I happened to run into last year at the International UFO Congress. I know you were there just, I think, last
year.
Yeah,
I was just there. Yep.
Yeah, it's a fantastic event.
Had a great time. Great people.
It's always good, you know, to see that many people coming together to take seriously the discussion of UFOs. And granted, I've been billed there in the past as a skeptic, and I maintain I'm someone who does not dismiss UFO reports in the least. I think there's a very compelling case to be made for them. There are some people who attend that have a slightly different attitude. And one of these individuals, I was talking with him, and when I brought up the idea of black projects and government technologies, he said, "You believe that?" And I said, "Well, I certainly do, because I think that certainly that has to be one component to this phenomenon." And I said, "Let's think for a moment and say if you wanted to rule out extraterrestrial technology, they'd have to be something else, wouldn't they?" And he said, "Yeah, but I don't think they're government craft. That information would be released to the public if that were the case." And I thought to myself, rolling my eyes a bit, "Now that's a little naive, I think, to presume all this would be released to the public with time." And I said, "So you think there's something else? What's that?" And he said, "I certainly do." And here I think, okay, I've got a hardline skeptic who's about to admit he really secretly believes in flying saucers. What we all want to hear, right? And he says to me, "It's simple. These people are all lying." And I suggested to him, I said, "Well, then we should just start a blog together and call it The Lying Saucer." And he said, no, we'd get sued." But in truth, that's really distasteful to say that everybody's lying and that there's no possibility at all that there are secret projects going on. I think personally, George, that maybe there are. Now, in relation to the other aspect of that question, Nazi technologies, when we look back to the Second World War, if we're going to talk about ghost rockets, and we're going to talk about what appear to be rockets and missiles that were seen buzzing around over Scandinavia and Sweden immediately after the Second World War, well, we know that the Allies, as well as the Russians, had managed to obtain certain missile technologies the Germans had been working on, and that, in fact, we'd actually managed to also gain actual German rocket specialists. You know, Wernher von Braun and Hermann Oberth came to work
Operation Paperclip, right?
That's right. Yeah, they came to Huntsville, Alabama, and worked for us. So quite clearly, there's, I think, a Nazi component. I don't know that there were Nazis after the war that were hiding out in a bunker someplace testing missiles, but certainly the technology that the Germans began to innovate during the Second World War has to play into this somehow.
Well, because the shape of these objects, and I'm looking at the great illustration on your cover of the Ghost rockets, to me, I've got to think that this is man-made, that something was going on, that they possessed, we possessed, somebody possessed high technology. And of course, that doesn't negate UFOs and flying saucers. They always seem to have that other shape, Micah, you know, that saucer type shape. And so I'm guessing that these things probably have originated on this planet. I don't know.
It's, you know, it's difficult to say. And again, when we look at something, I mean, I think the old saying goes, you know, well, if it looks like a duck, it's probably a duck. These objects that seem to behave like and that look like missiles or projectiles. See, I'm with you. I would say, yeah, that's in all likelihood, that's probably something of our own. Now, what's interesting, however, and again, which comes back around to the element of there being something secret or something perhaps that's been going on behind the scenes. And I'll tell you this. You know, call me believer, call me skeptic, call me what you want, but I do believe that there are elements to this ongoing narrative, this story that we have called the UFO phenomenon, going back to the 1940s and even earlier. There are elements to this story, clearly, that we don't have all the facts about. We don't know that full story yet. That's what we're trying to determine. And what I do know is that I believe that there have been instances where we have observed technologies which may seem extremely advanced, rather than being maybe hundreds or even thousands of years more advanced than we are, often these technologies are just a few years ahead of us. I mean, and sometimes this sort of technology, not even just in the Ghost Rockets reports, but looking at other elements of ufology, we see this emerge in other cases just as well. Betty and Barney Hill's abduction, the famous abduction that occurred there, you know, Betty described what later was known as an amniocentesis procedure for testing pregnancy. It didn't exist at the time that she was abducted, but later on it did become widely known and then, of course, widely used. We do hear about instances where technology in relation to UFO phenomena is really just a few years ahead of us. What was compelling about some of these 1940s reports of the rockets seen over Scandinavia, the first ghost rockets, is that while they may not have been something that was so far beyond that they couldn't be man-made, they did resemble, for instance, cruise missile technologies that didn't exist in 1946. So again, the question comes back around, well, if this was advanced enough not to exist in 46, but maybe not something so exotic that it couldn't be from here, well, who had it then? Who was operating with this kind of technology then, and what was the purpose behind it?
Well, what was the purpose? That's a great question. Something was happening. Now, you have relayed in the book some fascinating stories tied into the ghost rockets that could lead you to believe that these things could be extraterrestrial. What was one of the fascinating aspects for you when you were putting this together?
Well, you know, I'll tell you this. Not all the ghost rockets are simply little rockets and little missiles and little things that, you know, that might resemble, I guess, what we might like and do. Being in general terms a weaponized kind of a projectile. There are certain more compelling reports that to me are evidence of something else. They certainly are rocket-like in their propulsion, and they certainly are very curious. They're hard to make much sense of. A good example, and in fact, in the book, the very first chapter, I kick it off because this happens to be one of the earlier reports chronologically around the same time as what was going on in Sweden. That details a rocket-like technology. Captain Jack Puckett of Tactical Air Command was flying toward MacDill Air Force Base in the summer of 1946, here over the Americas, of course. What he describes seeing still, to my way of understanding, and I don't know that I would necessarily go so far as to say it was extraterrestrial, but this certainly stretches my brain. I don't know what this could have been. The object he described was roughly twice the size of a B-29 bomber, but imagine just the fuselage, George, just the middle portion, no wings, but twice the size of a B-29. This thing was moving almost on a collision course for his aircraft at incredible speed. There were two rows of what he described as illuminated portholes down either side of this object, and as he observed it, the thing produced a thick trail of smoke as it cruised past him at incredible speed, and he watched it disappear off into the distance. Now, that doesn't sound like a technology that exists today, let alone something that should have been flying around over the U.S. in 1946. And strangely, these reports of these large wingless fuselage type aircraft, or what I sometimes refer to as flying cigars,
that's right,
that did seem to operate a lot like a rocket in their propulsion.
And there were lots of reports of those back in the 50s and 60s.
There were, that's right. And of course, with your background with NICAP, I know you've looked into these things for a long time yourself. There have been, you know, more than just dozens. I mean, there may have been hundreds of reports of these cigar type craft. And so, yeah, that's one that, again, it's not quite so easy to dismiss as just being something man-made as these rockets that were reported over Sweden and Scandinavia. Some of these reports, seriously, folks, they really cause us to have to question what we think we know about the general history of aviation, and not just here in the United States, but maybe across the board. I couldn't tell you what that was that Captain Puckett saw. It wasn't the last time that aircraft was seen, though, and I document other cases similar to his in the book.
What are witnesses saying when they see these things en masse? What do they say?
You know, in a lot of instances, people are disturbed, and especially if you see something, if you are on board a craft. And, I don't mean to come on a program and be a fear-monger or someone who's promoting, sensationalism, because I don't think that if there were an overt danger to us, we would probably be aware of it by now. And across the board with regard to UFO research, I think that this very element has led often to the dismissive attitude by government agencies and, of course, scientific agencies along the lines of the Condon Committee. There doesn't seem to be any overt threat, and for scientific agencies, they don't have that hard nuts and bolts proof that proves conclusively that there's something either to observe or to worry about. So, I don't think that there's something that necessarily has to be concerning across the board for folks, but in the instances where people have actually had these encounters, people are often troubled because they see something that is behaving unlike anything that they've seen. They see an object that is described maybe like a torpedo or like a rugby ball in shape flying dangerously close to an aircraft. I know if I were on an aircraft, I think I would have to say that I would be apt to be both mixed with excitement at seeing something like that, being a writer and a researcher into this sort of thing, and also slightly terrified because I would want to know, my gosh, what are these things flying around in our airspace? Is this some sort of a technology that most of us just don't know about? And I certainly think that there's an element to this that we don't have the full story about just yet.
How far do you think military operations might be, black ops, from when it's finally unveiled? 5 years? 10 years?
That's hard to say. In relation to that, I think what it all comes down to, and granted, I'm no, military historian or aviation professional. I'm a writer, and I try and gather the facts. But in my opinion, a lot of it has to do with whether or not something is a national security concern. And so it's a little difficult to put a time frame on these things because it just depends on the relevancy and the issues that might arise from public knowledge of these kinds of things. But along that same line of thought, if we were to return to the case of Captain Jack Puckett, again, a more modern skeptical attitude toward that case might just be that, well, he made something up or maybe he mistook something. Let's take into consideration the time frame. This was 1946. Just a breath after the greatest conflict in modern time on a worldwide scale. It is not going to be helpful either for his career or in terms of the importance of maintaining national security to go around making up stories about an aircraft, which at that time, keeping in mind, this was, a good year prior to Kenneth Arnold's first observation of what became famously known as flying saucers of Washington. At that time, anyone who reported something that exotic is going to present the possibility that there is a technology, and if we can't identify it as ours, who does it have to belong to then?
All right, Micah, we're going to come back with you in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, take a peek at our television show, Beyond Belief, if you would. You can. 10 days free to look at that and all the other videos available through the Guyam Television Network. Beyond Belief, how do you get to it? www.beyondbelief.com. Welcome back with Micah Hanks, of course, his latest work, The Ghost Rockets. You have also looked at the downing of TWA Flight 800. What did you conclude there, Micah?
I'm both glad that you asked that question and, of course, always troubled to have to discuss it. It's one of those cases. cases that, you know, I think we've all looked at it if we're interested in this sort of thing. And, you know, I'm someone who is, admittedly, interested in conspiracy theories. I think that that term, ever since the Kennedy assassination, especially as employed by the media, it's been weaponized, and we see that more now than ever before. That the weaponization of conspiracy theory, you even allege that there may be more going on than what is publicly available data, yeah, and you're, you know, you're considered crazy. So there have been, since the outset with regard to TWA Flight 800, allegations that there may be more going on there than the official narrative has stated. And so in researching for the Ghost Rockets, it's a funny thing, George, because I guess, you know, as a writer, many of us kind of have an intuition. And, you know, if you've worked in news and broadcast, as I know you have, you've got that intuition. And something, as I was writing this book, kind of told me, you might want to look at that case. I didn't want to go in there and become an advocate for the missile theory, despite the fact that early on, and this is well known, the FBI and other agencies, the National Transportation Safety Board and others, they had considered, based on what eyewitness data had to bring to the table, that there very well likely could have been a missile that had been involved in what brought down the aircraft. What I began looking at was, of course, I looked at the official report. I looked at the data that they used to determine the official story, which was that there was essentially a spark, I think, that began in the center wing fuel tank, and that's what actually brought down the craft, and that literally the ignition that occurred aboard the craft itself was what people had seen that they believed was a flare or some sort of a projectile rising up and moving toward the aircraft. Now, I know a lot of folks out there probably have seen a documentary that came out. I think the Stars Network put that out last summer. And I watched this just as one. I have to tell you this. Having watched that after I wrote my book, they present some pretty compelling data in regard to the idea that there was an external explosion that may have brought down the plane. In other words, something outside the craft itself, not within that center wing fuel tank. Within my book, rather than trying to make a case for the missile or something like that striking or blowing up next to the aircraft, what I began to find were compelling reports of similar instances where flares, missiles, or projectile-like objects, just like what people had said around the time of the TWA Flight 800 crash, there were a few instances where similar things were seen in the months and even weeks leading up to and even after the TWA Flight 800 crash. Interestingly, you almost never hear about this in the documentaries and things that are produced in relation to that crash. And I think that this can be, in a sense, kind of a case of being so close to the mirror that we don't see our own reflection. And so I'll give you an idea of some of the kinds of things that people were seeing in the months and weeks leading up to the crash, and then also what occurred right afterward. For instance, November 17, 1995, there was a situation where there were actually two aircraft, British Airways Flight 226 and Lufthansa Flight 405. Keeping in mind that this was, you know, within a year of what happened with TWA Flight 800, the crews aboard both these aircraft observed a green projectile that they estimated to be flying at about 3,000 feet above and to the left of them. Now, they began to correspond with air traffic control at Boston and describe what they had seen. And later, actually, a friend of the program, Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center, he took interest in this case, and he managed to actually get a transcript of the conversation between the two flight crews aboard those aircraft in Boston ATC. Fast forward to June 26, 1996. TWA Flight 848 was en route to Rome, leaving JFK International Airport, when the Coast Guard began receiving reports that people were seeing what they described as bright flares rising up out of Long Island Sound and flying up into the air within 20 miles of Flight 848. Now, of course, and by November, this is following TWA Flight 800, but by November 16, 1996, we have another case where Pakistan International Airlines Flight 712, the crew aboard this craft actually observed an orange light as it passed just a few miles in front of them. They said it traveled from left to right. But now get this, there was another aircraft that was behind them, the crew of a TWA flight. They had been following, and as they were leaving JFK International Airport, they saw the craft ahead of them. They also saw this object that the crew aboard that craft had seen, but they watched it as it originated, they said, from down in the actual Long Island Sound, and it traveled upward and then moved out in front of this aircraft. In that case, and this is really interesting to me, Boston Air Traffic Control did manage to track two objects on their radars in conjunction with this object that rose up out of the sound. And the crew aboard that TWA flight that had observed this thing fly up out of the ocean, they were so terrified by what they saw, they wanted to turn back. They wanted to go back to JFK for obvious reasons, having followed the TWA Flight 800 incident. And that same night, there was another flight out of Fort Lauderdale that was headed to Boston, Flight 1504. The pilot aboard that craft also said he saw the flare rise up out of the ocean. So I think that the important thing is, and I want to leave it up to the listener, obviously the listeners, but of course the people who presumptuously will purchase this book and read it, I would hope that they would look at this and say, you know, let's just see what the evidence says. There's a lot of information out there about TWA Flight 800 already. What I'm offering are cases that do seem to involve flares or other strange objects that were seen in that vicinity before and after. What do we make of that? You know, I think that the facts kind of tell the story.
Micah, have you ever looked at the Phoenix Lights story of 1997?
Certainly, yeah. I've had some friends who actually had, I guess I should say, close encounters with that. You know, people who were in the area. You know, a good friend of mine, Chris O'Brien, who's got a new book coming out, he said he was there that night, but unfortunately he was indoors watching a ball game and walked outside and said he heard all these people making this commotion. They all talked about the series of lights that flew overhead. They said that they thought were part of some huge aircraft. So, yeah, I certainly have.
Close to a mile long, many people reported. That is unbelievable, isn't it?
It'd have to be pretty big, wouldn't it? And, you know, again, I'm interested, in addition to ghost rockets, and maybe on down the road I'll write something about this, but I'm interested in these reports of, I think, what people sometimes call stealth blimps, or they're sometimes referred to as flying triangles. A lot of people have seen these things, and you wouldn't believe, George, how many times I've just, you know, in random conversation with people, talking with them about UFOs, I write about UFOs, I write articles and books, and people will say, you know, I actually saw one of those. I saw one of those big, silent triangles one time, and they describe these things sometimes as being the size of a football field. What are they? Are they some secret DARPA project? You know, who knows? But I think that they're out there, and I've heard compelling reports from so many people that I just cannot dismiss the idea that there are probably technologies out there. But see, with those stealth blimps, I wonder if that's something of our own. When we talk about the Phoenix Lights, if what those people saw and what, of course, was famously captured on film, what the governor, Fife Sampington, I believe, had even said that he saw, if those were all a part of one large craft, I just can't imagine what technology we would have that would allow something that big to remain in the air. It's truly incredible.
Yeah, that guy, Governor Fife Sampington of Arizona, I mean, at that time, yeah, he held a news conference, had one of his aides dress up like an alien, and he mocked people, but he changed his mind. And I was on, Micah, on the Larry King show with him years ago, and he was a changed man. I mean, what he felt was this was out of this world. He didn't know what it was, but he surely wasn't the same guy when he was a governor who was, you know, acting silly and foolish about this. Something changed his mind and changed it in a big way.
Yeah, well, and of course, when you've got potentially an object as large as what was seen over Phoenix, there's nothing but big.
How do you hide it?
Yeah, it's got to be big. You know, and I'll tell you this, though, it can actually go in one of two ways, George. I think that people either respond to that, and it does represent a life-changing experience for them, having seen something that seems, if not impossible, bordering on the impossibility of existence. They either report to respond to that with awe and acceptance that, wow, maybe there's something more. Or, interestingly, people dismiss it. And this is the thing. I don't think necessarily sometimes that there's so much shadowy cover-up or something like that in relation to UFO reports as there is a simple, maybe psychological, element where people sometimes, when confronted with the seemingly impossible, I don't know that the mind can fully comprehend it at times. And I think that often, I mean, I've talked with local politicians here in Asheville, North Carolina, where I live, who on one occasion there was a gentleman member of city council. We asked if he'd ever had any strange experiences, and he goes, well, you know, now that you mention it. And then he went on to tell me one of the most incredible reports of a disc-shaped, red glowing flying saucer I'd ever heard in my life. I don't know why this guy, you know, a city council member, would want to tell me a tall tale about something like this. He seemed very credible in the way he reported it and remembered it. And then he said, and you know, I hadn't even thought about that until you asked about it. So I wonder sometimes if it, the dismissal that we often hear about isn't intentional, but it's one of a few ways that sometimes people react to their encounters with the seemingly extraordinary.
You've had a chance, of course, to talk with pilots, I think, who witnessed some incredible things. Have they been told, though, not to report?
There are some instances, yeah, where people are told not to talk about things that they have seen. And this is, of course, a consistent narrative that we see throughout UFO reports. And again, you know, I'm not talking necessarily about, you know, people being silenced. You know, of course, those infamous and unfriendly men in black suits showing up, knocking on the door and saying, you're not going to talk about what you saw. You know, in more general terms, I think what it tends to involve is that a person sees something strange and they want to make sure that that this is on the record. Because, again, as I was saying before we went to the last break about Captain Jack Puckett, when you report about something that is seemingly so otherworldly, at that time in 1946, the only way I would think, again, immediately before the modern UFO era began in 1947, the only way I could think that people would interpret that is, my gosh, is this enemy aircraft? It certainly wasn't ours. And what are they doing in our airspace? So there's a national security interest there. When that is present, I think that people are faced with the potential for a lot of issues. You might even use the term blowback after a you know, fashion. So I think that people are concerned about this, and people in officialdom want to protect against the possibility of litigation, against the possibility of national security issues. And a lot of these factors have to come into question. And rather than it being a vile, nefarious situation where people are threatened and ordered not to talk, I think it sometimes does have to do with legitimate national security problems. That's why it's so important to understand that in the last chapter of the Ghost Rockets, where I get a lot of the information about these cases, I've said, you know, of course, that NASA oversees this aviation safety reporting system. By the 1960s, the FAA had begun to recognize, aviation professionals were beginning to recognize, you know, people are afraid that they're going to be ridiculed or told not to talk about these things. There's going to be a fear of being silenced. There's going to be the fear of litigation and all kinds of problems that might arise from putting their name behind certain experiences they've had and things that they've seen. And so this is the reason why with the aviation safety reporting system, the database collects information anonymously from people so they don't have to worry about the concerns associated with putting their names behind things. I think a lot of people might look at that and say, why wouldn't you gather as much information about an individual witness as you could? This is designed, this system, for collecting UFO reports. It's usually, you know, ice on the runway, electrical issues observed on board a plane, things that could be legitimate aeronautical or aviation concerns, hazards. But when people are seeing objects that resemble rugby balls, bullets, torpedoes, mm-hmm. missiles, and projectiles buzzing around and sometimes flying very close to an aircraft, that too is potentially a concern to an aircraft in flight. And so I think that there's a necessity for those aforementioned reasons why people sometimes need to be able to be anonymous about it. And to me, George, that doesn't take away from the legitimacy that we can put behind those reports. I think that they're very good reports. The data is really good. There are always follow-ups when these reports are collected and then later entered into the Aviation Reporting Safety Center databases. And interestingly, if you go in there and you look at all the acronyms that they use, you'll find that UFO is among those acronyms. Now, I don't think that that means that NASA is secretly looking for spaceships. They're using that in the traditional term, the usage of the term that was employed first by Edward Ruppelt, first leader of Project Blue Book, unidentified flying object.
And a believer, by the way. He changed, too.
He was. You know, people often said that later he changed his mind and was more dismissive of the UFO phenomenon. And then further allegations are that he, of course, died mysteriously. He did die at a very young age, and shortly after issuing an amended version of his report on unidentified flying objects. But, you know, I think that Ruppelt was just like you or I. He was looking for the facts. And from time to time, as we get older, as we gain more information, we may change our opinions on things based on what the facts entail. But, again, the bottom line is that, yes, UFO, he first employed that term. It meant unidentified flying object. And yes, Aviation Safety Reporting System and other agencies too, they still use that because pilots are seeing aircraft at times in certain circumstances that they cannot identify.
I'm at odds with my dear friend Stephen Bassett. We've given him two awards in the last few weeks, one at the Conscious Life and the other at the UFO Congress for his incredible work. But he still believes disclosure's coming. And I just keep trying to tell him, Micah, it's not coming from governments. It's not going to happen. What do you think about disclosure?
I think I'm glad that you're telling him that. George, I got to tell you, I'm right there with you, my friend. I think that there are two issues there. First of all, I don't know how much information really is being withheld by government. And a lot of people would hear that and they would go, what? Okay, maybe this is the skeptic coming out here. But what I mean by that is that, again, you know, Colonel John Alexander, he wrote a fantastic book on UFOs that I recommend to anyone. My friend Richard Dolan recommended it to me, and I'm so glad he did. If you want to understand the government component with UFO reports, I recommend John Alexander's book on UFOs to anybody.
Yeah.
But also, it's important to understand that if there is information being withheld, again, as I was mentioning earlier, talking with that hardline skeptic at the Congress last year who said, oh, that information, if it were government projects, that would have been released within a few years. You know, how long was it before there was official recognition released in regard to Area 51? I mean, we've known about it for years, but it was just recently that official CIA documents that actually referred to the location came about. And we've known about it, again, for a long time, but, you know, government's often a lot more slow to be forthcoming with information. And whether or not there's information being withheld about UFOs, George, I'm of like mind with you. I'm not convinced that we're going to be able to put all our money behind disclosure. Now, Stephen Bassett, what he's doing, I think it's good. I think there's really good intention behind it. I don't mean to be overtly critical of the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure, but again, I do worry sometimes that maybe there are instances where if we have funding and we have the ability to change the minds of individuals, we need to be very careful whose minds we try to change and what ideas we get behind. I just don't know about the whole disclosure thing personally.
Did you ever look at the Kenneth Arnold case where he saw all those flying discs?
I certainly did. As a matter of fact, George, I you know, I've written about that a lot, and I think that there is an idea, especially not just in the UFO community, I think just in general, that if something has been written about in the past, it shouldn't be rehashed. And I already have said once during this interview that I'm not really a big fan of necessarily, you know, just rehashing things ad nauseum. With the ghost rockets, you know, I've tried to present a lot of new information. And for instance, with the Aviation Safety Reporting System information on these rocket-like objects, I don't know that anyone has reported on these cases, especially in relation to possible UFO sightings. So this is kind of a new thing. That's what I like to try and do. So why would you want to spend time looking at something like Kenneth Arnold? Everybody's written about this already, right? So I decided to do something a little different with Kenneth Arnold. And over the course of the last few years, you know, I've off and on come back to this and looked at it. Keep in mind that Kenneth Arnold, when he first reported what he saw, he had described seeing what he thought were military aircraft. He didn't describe them at the outset as being disc-shaped necessarily. He said that they may have resembled flying wing-type aircraft. Mm-hmm. When asked by the press, well, how did they fly? How did they move? Arnold said, well, you know, they were erratic. Imagine like a saucer skipping across the water. And thus a legend was born. Truly, as we often see, the press took that, they ran with it, and started referring to flying saucers. Now, interestingly, and I don't think that this in any way casts doubt over the testimony presented by Kenneth Arnold, but I think that what we tend to see is that people's idea about their own memory even can change with time. There are scientific studies that have proven that people tend to update memories so that they're better suited for interpreting something that's happening in the present. Kenneth's interpretation.
Hold on for a second, Michael.
Sure.
We're already at the top of the hour. Fast night. We'll take calls and continue chatting about the ghost rock.